So, hello, thanks for joining us today. We are going to be talking about what a post-quantum future would look like in Bitcoin. So, I'm excited to be talking about this. A lot of research went into this, but still don't hold me accountable if I say something incorrect. This is a complicated topic. We're not going to go too technical, but we will a little bit. We've got two people from our CVP committee today and a special guest. Let's do introductions. I'm Jessica, Executive Director, and Rodney, do you want to get us started?
Sure. My name is Rodney McInnes. I am the chair of the Certified Bitcoin Professional Committee.
And
And
that's it's like that's the end of it.
that's it.
All
I'm
right.
Dirk. I'm on the Certified Bitcoin Professional Committee.
There are way
I'm
more
also
important things
on
to talk about.
the Cryptocurrency Security Standard Guidance Committee as well.
Perfect. Jameson?
I'm co-founder and chief security officer at Casa, and I'm on the standards committee with Dirk.
Awesome. So we're talking about what a post-quantum future might look like. We're not trying to be alarmist. We're just explaining what is happening, and we'll do a little technical and a little overarching, but maybe we should just start first by saying there's no need to freak out right now. It's going to be okay. But there are some things that may need to happen at some point, and we want to make sure everybody's informed about it. So, yeah. Let's get into what quantum computing is to start, maybe, and just kind of do an overview. Who wants to do the overview of how Bitcoin is secured so we can then get into what quantum computing is? Why is this even a thing that we're talking about?
Let me see if I can do a really dumbed down version.
Please.
Bitcoin is, yes. Bitcoin is secured by math, or more specifically, by very, very large numbers. And the cryptography behind Bitcoin, you may see the term like ECDSA, elliptic curve digital signature algorithm. We don't need to dig into how all of that works, but basically the magic behind it is that it's very difficult to factor prime numbers. And like this is where quantum computing in theory could shift the problem of factoring primes, which takes exponentially large amounts of time for a classical computer, which is all computers today, to figure out. It may shift that into what is called polynomial time, which is just orders of magnitude faster. And basically decrease the computational security of our cryptography by orders of magnitude.
That's
Yeah,
pretty good.
and I think what's really important for that specifically around Bitcoin, right, is that the math and the cryptography that Jameson's referring to there is what's used in a couple of different ways in Bitcoin, right? One is it's utilized to protect your wallet or your assets on the blockchain, right? So the cryptographic keys are the way that you can identify that this is in fact my wallet and this is my Bitcoin, my money, and how that's protected. And then it's also used the hashing algorithms are also used in the actual network, the Bitcoin network, in order to go through the process of validating transactions that are being added to the block. And so when you start when those things are designed around mathematical problems and you, like Jameson said, s dramatically simplify or potentially simplify the ability to do those problems, and that then that can have an impact, a trickle-down impact, not just in the world of Bitcoin, but banking and online shopping and everywhere else that we utilize cryptography for for protecting our information.
Yeah, and if you are a CBP, you would have heard about ECDSA and how we use elliptic curve to secure digital signatures, right? Or to securely sign transactions. And so this would mean that we'd have to find a different way to do that because the computers will be better at math. That's probably the dumbest way to say it, better at math, but I'm sticking with it. So,
and better at a particular kind of math.
Yes, got it. Okay, so we know that we're talking about cryptography, but we're not going to get too far into it. But now that we've got an idea of why this matters for Bitcoin, why don't we talk about what quantum computing is? It's interesting. Like, I heard about quantum physics a long time and then got into Bitcoin. And that's when I think I really started to hear more about quantum computing. I don't know if I ever really thought about it before then. Maybe it's just me because I'm not a computer scientist or technologist. But do we want to explain what quantum computing is from a high level and basically just how it's using principles from quantum physics? And does that, by doing that, it processes information more quickly, right? And that's the math that you're talking about, right? Jameson can compute it much, much faster, which is why it can break things. No, is that not what we would say? Okay, so it doesn't break things, but it can speed up problem solving. And that causes the problem.
Right. So, I mean, it's a fundamentally different type of computing altogether, where classical computers right now, they all operate on essentially a binary system. I'm sure you've all heard of bits and bytes, ones and zeros. Fundamentally, everything that a computer does is just processing a bunch of ones and zeros. And those are, you know, going through various logical gates at the hardware level that are then just manipulating the ones and zeros into other ones and zeros. And, you know, there's many, many layers of software and hardware abstraction that we've built up over the decades that then allow someone to, like, write a programming language that gets compiled down into instructions that manipulate all of these ones and zeros. But quantum computing is a bit different in that instead of having bits that we're operating on, we have qubits. And this is where we get, like, beyond even my own real understanding and ability to explain all of this, because I'm not a quantum computing expert either. But you essentially think of it as kind of at a fundamental level, you know, the reason that quantum physics and quantum anything is so mind-boggling is because you're talking about, like, potentially multiple things happening simultaneously, right? Like, potentially even multiple realities, and you're just trying to collapse and coalesce from many, many possibilities onto one or a few more concrete possibilities. And so the idea of being able to build what we would call a cryptographically relevant quantum computer would be one that would have a sufficient number of qubits that you would be able to have this massive space of many possibilities and calculations going on simultaneously that you can then collapse down to your single solution that you want. Now, it gets even more complicated than that, because one qubit is not equal to one qubit. There are physical qubits, there are logical qubits, there are additional complexities in getting the qubits to actually work with each other at the same time. So you get the physical qubits working together in order to build and create larger logical qubits, and there's signals and noise and decoherence issues. And so it's not as simple as saying that, like, if we get a quantum computer with X number of qubits, then it will be able to break Bitcoin cryptography. It's because there's so many other variables at play that it's hard to say how far away we are from actually developing a quantum computer that is worth worrying about. And this is one of the many reasons why this entire topic is so contentious, is because the people who say, you know, it's silly to even be talking about this, they will rightfully point out that at the moment, no one has really invented a quantum computer with more than a handful of actual logical qubits, like one or two logical qubits that are maybe comprised of several dozen physical qubits. And as such, I don't think that anyone has successfully factored a number larger than like 12 or something, 12 or 15, using a quantum computer. And of course, in order to break Bitcoin cryptography, you're going to have to be able to factor numbers that are orders and orders of magnitude larger than that. So this is why this is not an emergency right now. We're still orders and orders of magnitude away from Bitcoin being broken. And as Dirk already said, quantum computers that are powerful enough would affect all types of systems, not just Bitcoin. But the reason why we don't really need to worry as much about your average website or e-commerce or even banking app is because those systems are centralized and they can and they will upgrade their cryptography very quickly. As they are observing this threat potentially growing as the technology advances. But Bitcoin and really any public permissionless distributed crypto system tends to be very difficult to upgrade because you have to get consensus amongst the vast majority of ecosystem participants, and then get this trickle down effect where first you have to fix it at the protocol level, and then that has to go out and matriculate to all of the different like software wallets, and then the hardware wallets, and basically all the different pieces of infrastructure that compose the network for that crypto system. So, I'm not worried about quantum computers breaking stuff anytime in the next few years. What I'm worried about is just Bitcoin being so very difficult to come to consensus on, and the fact that this is a very hand-wavy topic where it's difficult. No one can actually say how many years we have. Some people will say it that we will never have a cryptographically relevant quantum computer. So the answer is probably somewhere in between. There already being one that is like secretly developed by the NSA versus there never being one because the laws of quantum physics will make it physically impossible to actually construct.
One of the things that I found interesting when I was looking into this is there are already encryption methods. There's already options for like what we can switch over to. So it's not how are we going to do this? It's how are we going, like you said, Jameson, banks can just switch over because there already are like NIST approved, NSA, I think, picked one. There's already like a Q block or Q Bitcoin, which we can talk about. But so all this stuff, it's like the technology exists already for what we need to use when quantum computing is a reality. But with Bitcoin, because it's we need to reach consensus, it's actually getting it to happen, having the people agree on it, implementing it, and then figuring out how to migrate everything after that. And Dirk, were you going to jump in and say something
Well,
too?
that's, yeah, I was going to say that's why I actually called out earlier that it makes us, it's better at a certain kind of math, right? That, yeah, because there are algorithms that that have been developed that aren't susceptible to the same sorts of calculation that would, what would say, break, right, the ECDSA or the some of the other algorithms and stuff that are in use right now. So yeah, the big issue, it's not a technological issue, right? And I think that should bring some reassurance to some people, right? That it's not a we don't know how to address this kind of from a security perspective. Like Jameson saying, there's a much, much bigger sociological concern here when it comes to Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies because they're intentionally decentralized, and Bitcoin especially because it was designed to move slowly, right? To change slowly and not break, and kind of the philosophical approach to it was, we've built this thing, it's good. Like, don't mess around with it, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's also an issue of constraints. Like I already said, centralized systems, they're controlled by a handful of people. They don't have to come to consensus. They can roll out whatever they want to pretty quickly. But with regard to the fact that there's at least half a dozen post-quantum crypto algorithms out there, and any number of them could work for most applications, they all suck when it comes to the constraints imposed by Bitcoin. Usually, the constraint that becomes a problem is the data size of the signature itself. Sometimes the data size of the public keys. Some of these also are very slow to validate. They all have different trade-offs. But when I started looking at this issue in context of Bitcoin, I found it was extremely gnarly in the sense that there are actually many different contentious issues that will need to be overcome simultaneously. One of them is like which post-quantum scheme do we use, because they all have different trade-offs. Another one is that depending on which post-quantum scheme gets settled upon, it's almost assuredly going to use more block space, and that could potentially reignite the block size debate, which we already spent a number of years going through, like 8 years ago. There's also potential inviolable properties in conflict when we then start going down the philosophical question of what should happen to the vulnerable Bitcoin, and like should we try to push people to migrate their coins and discuss freezing coins that are vulnerable if they don't get migrated by a certain point in time.
Wait, let's back up, because I don't want you to get into this yet, because this is like the second point of contention, right? Like, how are we going to do this? And I want to like get into, I geeked out over this today. I surprised myself in how interesting I found this. I watched a PBS special a while ago about quantum physics and like alternate realities, and it made me it, that's basically what it is. When you talk about qubits, it's not a zero or a one like bits. It is a zero and a one. You don't know what it can do, multiple things, right? Which is why we're saying big math. But if we back up just a little bit, which is hard because I feel like I have dove into this, like jumped in today. But we know that the issue is that we need to figure out how, not we have to decide which digital signature algorithm will be used. There are a bunch of them. You said six. I thought there were only three, but so six options for different algorithms, but the community needs to agree on it. And then what Jameson was just getting at, which we'll talk more about too, is in addition to that, it's going to change old wallets, and we have to figure out how to make that work. But Dirk, did you want to say something else related to this before
No.
I keep going? Okay, so this post-quantum world, we don't really know what it's going to be like. I feel like it's like sci-fi alternate realities kind of what it could do. Maybe I went too far down the rabbit hole today. That's a possibility. But when we're like, if we back up about it, it's strange to have a solution for something, but to not, because of consensus, which like is I think why we all fell in love with Bitcoin, because it's decentralized, it's peer-to-peer, there isn't some central authority telling us what to do, which then means we need to like duke it out in forums to figure out what it is we're going to do moving forward, right? I feel like that kind of put together what we've been talking about. Is that a good summary of that? Anything that we talk about that I missed before we get into some of the other options? No?
On
Wait
the
one second.
bright side, a future with powerful quantum computers should result in a number of interesting technological breakthroughs in fields beyond cryptography, such as biology and chemistry and physics and so on and so forth. So, while it does potentially pose an existential crisis to cryptographically secured systems, it will hopefully also be a boon for humanity and allow us to continue advancing civilization.
Yeah, especially anything that requires modeling, because like you said, right, what a quantum computer does is instead of, like Jameson was saying earlier, right, instead of kind of going linearly through like trying to solve a problem, like trying to solve a math problem, if you're trying to figure out what a very large prime is, you have to, what a traditional computer does is it just tries things, right? It just tries a number, tries a number, tries a number, tries a number. And even if you have a multi-threaded system, right, there's a very limited number of things it can try at a time versus a quantum computer, which generates probabilities and says, hey, here's the set of probabilities, right, that this could be. And then you have to validate them. And validation is much easier mathematically than actually finding it in the first place. So in the same way, like Jameson's saying, right? Like anything that especially that utilizes that has complex mathematics for modeling, right? For like weather systems and stuff like that, right? The potential boon or all of the options for like vaccines and actually like customized vaccines for specific people and that sort of thing, right? That sort of modeling becomes much, much easier. Targeted medicine for the very specific cancer you have or something like that. Designing things for that can become much, much easier for the same reasons that it becomes easier to potentially break this traditional cryptography that we're using.
One of the things that I don't know who said this, but I think it was you, Jameson, getting into the block size and how different the different algorithms propose different, like you said, constraints. And so if what Jameson referred to in terms of like the prior block size, there was a huge debate for 2 years, I think, about whether or not the witness data should be segregated, and it ended up being SegWit. But that's what you're talking about, right, Jameson, with the block size debate, and that's what it led to, or is there a different piece of
Yeah, I
history?
mean, there were multiple aspects to it, but the main one, I mean, the main point of the block size debate was answering a single question, and the question was, should Bitcoin be optimized for low cost of validating and auditing the system, or should Bitcoin be optimized for low cost of transacting on the system? And so, after many, many years of debate and then ultimately contentious forks, it became clear that the community overwhelmingly preferred to optimize for low cost of validating the system. Now, if we get to the point where we determine that we need post-quantum cryptography and we survey the field of available algorithms, and like I said, they all have different trade-offs, and some of them are fairly novel, and novel cryptographic algorithms are always scary, because you don't know how much effort has been expended trying to break them. But I don't think that I've seen any that aren't at least like 100 times larger than what we're currently using. And so then you could very easily say, if the throughput, if the transaction throughput on chain for Bitcoin suddenly becomes an order of magnitude or more decreased, how does that affect people's sovereignty, their ability to use the system? And I'm not sure whether or not it will play out the same. You're effectively saying, okay, now you have to purchase 10 times, if not more, as much block space in order to transact. Will the Bitcoin ecosystem decide once again that that's just the price that you have to pay? Or will there be a willingness to increase that some proportional amount, understanding that hardware and technological progress does make things cheaper, right? It makes resources like bandwidth and CPU and disk space cheaper over time. But that's what the block size debate was all about. And I don't know, it just seems like it could be the block size debate on steroids.
I was just
One of
thinking
the
that. I mean, oh, go ahead, Rodney.
Oh, I was just gonna say one of the beauties is this, like the one of the perks and awesome factor pieces of information related to Bitcoin is you have the ability to fork it yourself and create quantum Bitcoin Cash if that's what you feel like doing.
The block size debate is like, I mean, yeah, good point, Rodney. The block size debate is fascinating, like you said, like 2 years of this, and then, like you said, on steroids. It's so true because now we're back to that argument basically to figure out how to do it, and so we need to reach consensus or bunch of forks, right? The last time there were a bunch of forks based on what was going on with the block size debate in 2017.
I'd say it's a little bit different, though, in that there is still there's this potentially existential deadline, right? Whether that's, how far out that is, and like Jameson said, right, predicting when, if and when that might occur, but it's not kind of just a philosophical efficiency sort of, debate. The idea that if we get to that point, right, that one of two things could really happen, right? Either your the cryptographic algorithms protecting your Bitcoin become invalid or compromised, and people can just steal the Bitcoin, which would lead to the second one, which is the value of Bitcoin would just inherently collapse, right? If you lose the ability to maintain the network and the chain, the blockchain, right, with integrity, then the entire point of Bitcoin kind of goes away. And so I think that that's maybe a little bit different motivator to try and work towards some sort of a solution.
Well, there's also if the on-chain transaction throughput plummets as a result of the post-quantum cryptography sizes being massive, that also greatly extends the time frame you need for migration of funds. Because, I mean, I think that at least if we go down the route of exploring using any of these more novel, like not the hash-based schemes, but any of the actual like post-quantum signature algorithms, then that means that we think that it's actually going to become necessary, and that means that we think that people need to move their funds, which has never been necessary before. And last I checked, I mean, that would, at a best case scenario, I think it would take several months to get like 95 to 99% of the Bitcoin value worth of funds. And that's assuming like the most optimal use of block space, which of course is never going to happen. Like people aren't going to coordinate around that. And worst case scenario, I mean, we're talking many years to actually get people to migrate their funds. And it gets even worse when you consider the fact that if you do this without a deadline, then people are naturally procrastinators, and you should expect that probably a lot, if not most people, will wait until there's an actual emergency, and then everybody's running for the exits, so to speak, and the blockchain would be quite congested with people trying to migrate their funds in an emergency.
So what I think we're saying is there's not an emergency right now to do anything. There are smart people on this figuring this out, debating what makes the most sense. And I don't want to say we can rest assured because I guess I can because I'm not the one that's capable of doing this, but the people that are actually working on it, there's a solution. It's just trying to wrangle it all together and get things pushed out. But for users right now, I think there's a lot of like because there's uncertainty, there's this fear, there's fear mongering, like this is going to happen, Bitcoin's going to go down, there's all kinds of things. I've started to see products even that are claiming to be like post-quantum ready. So people are concerned and trying to make changes right now. Is that true? Are there post-quantum ready wallets that we can be using?
Well, so I know Trezor 7 had some like post-quantum ready chip in it. And I think that they're mainly using that for the actual attestation of the integrity of the firmware itself. Like, there, until something gets implemented at the protocol level, there is no wallet that can actually protect you, at least if you have exposed public keys. And I guess we haven't gone down that rabbit hole. The best thing that you can do right now to stay safe against a quantum attacker is to ensure that your public keys have not been exposed on the blockchain. Now, how do you do that? Well, first of all, you don't want to use a Taproot address because that exposes the public key automatically. And second is you don't want to reuse Bitcoin addresses. And this has always been one of the most fundamental best practices of Bitcoin, mainly from a privacy perspective. I'm pretty sure even Satoshi said not to reuse Bitcoin addresses. Reason that it becomes a problem from a quantum attack perspective is that when you are sending multiple deposits to the same address, those deposits are creating different UTXOs, but then eventually when you go to spend some funds, you're going to consume one of those UTXOs. And when you do that, when you spend those funds, you then have to publish the public key to the blockchain, and then publish the public key and the corresponding cryptographic signature, and that's how the entire world and the nodes validate that you are actually legitimately the owner of the private key that belongs to that address where the funds were. But you're probably going to be leaving other funds, those other UTXOs that are protected by the same public-private key pair, sitting, you know, in those same UTXOs. And this is when you become susceptible to what's called a long range attack, which means that because you have exposed the raw public key, now if someone comes along with a quantum computer that is powerful enough, they can attempt to use Shor's algorithm to essentially reverse engineer the corresponding private key to the public key you exposed. And then if they find it, they would be able to sweep the funds that are in the other UTXOs that you haven't spent yet. And so this is one of the reasons why it's potentially an existential crisis if a quantum computer appears suddenly and surprises us all. Because if you go look at the top 100 Bitcoin rich list of addresses, you'll note that many of the largest exchanges like Binance and Bitfinex and so on have hundreds of thousands of Bitcoin sitting in addresses with exposed public keys because they're reusing those addresses. And so if I wanted to wreak maximum havoc, I would just have to, you know, reverse engineer that one private key to one of those addresses and immediately have access to hundreds of thousands of Bitcoin.
So we need to have quantum safe recovery, like a way to migrate what we have in wallets. And while we're working on that right now, what you can do is not reuse addresses, because like Jameson said, I mean, we're talking about public-private key pairs, and quantum is what would make it capable. So it goes private key, then public key, and then address. And so the address could work its way back. You could work your way back from quantum computing. I don't know if that was helpful, but basically it's using the technology, the new technology, to I guess I said break earlier, but to get information from what we're currently using. Dirk, did you want to add something?
I was just going to go back to what you said earlier. The main thing I've heard, you were talking about, like, you know, kind of advertising for quantum resistant, is that, and I think it's worth mentioning, right, that outside of Bitcoin, there are already some blockchains that are believed to be quantum resistant, right? They already utilize some of those other algorithms we were talking about. Algorand uses Falcon you know, is designed to be post-quantum. IOTA and a couple of others utilize Watts, I can't remember it. Winternet.
Was that Winternet signatures? Yeah, something like that.
For their calculations. So there are blockchains that are already kind of designed from the ground up to utilize some of those technologies. But James,
they're not Bitcoin.
Until you actually have like a solution at the chain level, right? And you know what the addresses are actually going to look like. It's pretty hard to say you've designed a, you know, post-quantum ready, you know, hardware wallet or something like that, because it's going to have to be able to interact with whatever the chain winds up looking like. So
from a personal paranoia perspective, would it be, and this is like just a personal question, would it be smart to move anything that you've sent to or received from, or received into, I guess, like a BC1P like Taproot address into like a BC1Q like native SegWit BEC32 address?
I'm nodding, but I assume this is for Jameson and not me.
I mean, you can look at it from a game theory perspective. I wouldn't worry about having your funds being swept out of an exposed pub key address unless you have like thousands of Bitcoin in them. Like, you know, a logical attacker is going to scan the blockchain and the order by like how much Bitcoin is in each pub key and just start going down the list. Now, some people have argued that no, if you really wanted to be a smart, stealthy attacker, you would, you know, start out elsewhere and start just like sniping little bits here and there. But I don't think that makes a lot of sense if we're considering that, you know, these attackers are essentially going to be either state-sponsored or massive VC-backed that have spent billions of dollars on this technology, and they're not going to be going after just a few million dollars here and there. Like, they're going to be going for payday, because I think that the way that you should approach the logic is similar to how zero-day exploits are used. It's like if you're a sophisticated hacker and you come across a zero-day exploit, you try to maximize the benefit that you can get from it, because you have to operate under the assumption that you're on the clock and that someone else is going to find the exploit, and or you know, maybe they're a black hat or maybe they're a white hat and they're gonna go, you know, patch the problem. But essentially, like, you have a limited time monopoly to deal with the problem. Otherwise, someone else is gonna use the exploit and essentially prevent you from being able to profit maximally.
Okay.
And I think in the case of Bitcoin, that's compounded even by the fact that once somebody realizes that that's happening, that it's, if it's like already actually broken and somebody can do this, the value of what you're stealing is going to plummet, right? So the minute that somebody, you know, uses quantum computing to steal a few thousand Bitcoin from some wallet, the value and the community realizes that, right, that's going to be that panic moment, that crisis moment, and Bitcoin would become you know, negligible in its value. The price in fiat for Bitcoin is going to drop. And so So there's a really short period of time then for somebody to do it and monetize it, right? Before it has no
Yeah, I
value.
mean, I suspect that like the it's possible that the maximum profitable path for exploiting a quantum computer on Bitcoin is actually to, take out a massive short position and then go after, one of the cold storage addresses, like I said, from one of the top few exchanges. And not even try to deal with the fact that it's going to be very difficult to liquidate, but
Right.
rather just understand that as soon as you do it, the market will panic.
Right. Yeah,
Yeah.
that's true.
So there's a good question in the chat, which brings us to the next point that we want to talk about. So the question is, what would happen to Satoshi's dormant stash and lost BTC? So in order to answer that, I think we should start to talk. So we talked about this first problem with consensus and protocol changes, but then we have another situation, which is what do we do with migrating funds? How are we going, what would happen to Satoshi's wallet? And I think the answer is it depends on what migration is, like what BIP goes through. And I'm not going to pretend like I can explain this as well as one of the people who wrote one of the BIPs. So, Jameson, do you want to explain to us what you and some others have made a suggestion for quantum migration, and I'll put the link to the GitHub as well.
So to put some numbers on it, all of the coins that are suspected to be Satoshi's, plus a bunch of the other early mined coins that were never spent, there's about 1.7 million Bitcoin in these pay to public key UTXOs. This was like the original Bitcoin address, if you were. And these are problematic because, unlike the next more popular pay to public key hash type of address, as you might see, they are not protected by a hash. So literally, the public key is exposed on the blockchain for all of these coins, including all the ones mined by Satoshi. So that's 1.7 million Bitcoin that are at risk there. Then there's another 4 to 5 million Bitcoin that have exposed public keys solely due to address reuse. And yeah, this is where the question comes into play. Do we take some sort of action to prevent those from falling into the wrong hands? There's no way really to ensure that there's no way to know whether or not coins are lost. And so there's no way to ensure that if you freeze coins, that you're not also locking out the rightful owner because they were just like too busy and not paying attention or whatever. Like, so this is why I often say that, if quantum computers become a real threat, then whether we do something or do nothing, there are going to be inviolable properties of Bitcoin that get violated. And that comes down to like the sovereignty aspects of like you should, never freeze anyone's money, you should never break anyone's Bitcoin, versus the not your keys, not your coins aspect, which is the property that is basically going to get violated by quantum computers, where we all operated under the idea that, if I am the only one who has my keys, I'm the only one who has my Bitcoin. And now all of a sudden someone else can get my keys and there's nothing I can do about it. That's not great.
It's probably worth just mentioning for, those people who are thinking through all this now, that all of those early Bitcoin, the Satoshi era Bitcoin, right, and the addresses that Jameson was talking about are almost all in 50 Bitcoin chunks in individual wallets, right? Because that was just kind of the way that it worked with the mining at the time, right? Is that you'd get the mining reward of 50 bitcoins, and those were all going into those individual wallets. So that's actually, this is before HD keys and derived key paths and all of that. And so every one of those kind of has to be broken individually if you're actually trying to break them. But I think again that that's the lesser issue, and this is actually from a previous conversation I had with Jameson, right? Is not people necessarily going after those, it's the value of the entire ecosystem tanking, because of all you have to do is move one of those wallets, and the impact to the entire ecosystem is dramatic. We've seen that, every time the price of Bitcoin tanks just because some whale moves a bunch of coins, right?
So what would be an option? So for, accounts or addresses that have a lot of Bitcoin that we think that have been dormant and we're guessing perhaps won't be moving these legacy wallets into new wallets because maybe the keys were lost, maybe the person's not alive anymore, who knows? Jameson, you've made a proposal for how we could make a change so that this catastrophic situation that people anticipate could happen doesn't. So I know you've got a proposal where you've got three phases. Do you want to walk us through what that would look like? Is that too technical?
Well, so like I said, I think it's if we end up being faced with this, it's going to be contentious, regardless. But what I'm interested in is in looking at this from a perspective of ecosystem-wide security and trying to deal with the fact that we know that people tend to be procrastinators. And so I want to motivate and incentivize individuals to take action for their security rather than having this sort of vague concept that like something may happen in the future. I'll just wait around until there's more concrete and existential issue to deal with. And I mean, I would also like to disincentivize quantum capable adversaries from pointing their machines at Bitcoin in the first place by essentially neutering the capability for them to profit from it and disrupt the system. And so it's not just necessarily that a quantum attacker is going to want to steal Bitcoin for their own personal gain. Like I said, quantum itself is kind of a nation state arms race. And so while it may be a US venture backed company that is profit motivated that wins the race, it may be a essentially Chinese Communist Party controlled company that ends up doing it. And maybe they just want to destroy Bitcoin because they hate it, or even because perhaps the United States builds up an even more massive strategic Bitcoin reserve and they want to destroy it. Who knows? I think that we've spent a ton of time going down rabbit holes of all the different possible motivations for attackers. But the point is, if anyone can do it, we should assume worst case scenario that it could happen and how do we try to mitigate it? And then I think that one important thing to understand with all this is recognizing that just adding in like an opt-in post-quantum security for people who voluntarily upgrade their wallets ahead of time does not protect anyone. Well, it doesn't protect them, even if they opt in to the security, from experiencing massive value loss as a result of everyone else not opting in, and thus, once again having this sort of market panic if the worst comes to pass. And I also think that it would just send a very strong signal to the world that Bitcoin is capable of adapting and confronting and responding to new threats. So the proposal that I've put together so far is basically How can we create a multi-stage, very slow and methodical migration process? Because it's not possible to, email every Bitcoin user and say, "Hey, you really need to upgrade." There is no way to communicate to everyone like
And
that.
even if you did, people ignore, like, don't
Yeah.
read emails, ignore things anyway. So even if there was a way to, like, dial into people's brains, a lot of people wouldn't do it anyway. Some of us would,
Yeah.
but yeah.
So basically, what I'm envisioning is, first of all, I'm not proposing a particular post-quantum scheme. My BIP is reliant upon us already deciding upon some post-quantum scheme and deciding that it needs to be enforced at some point in the like medium future. So I expect that we'll probably see some opt-in only schemes come out over the next year or two. And that's fine, especially some of the schemes that are coming out that are just going to be kind of like hidden optional taproot spending schemes that like won't really affect any of the normal ongoing operation of Bitcoin as it is. But if we get to the point where we say, okay, like quantum computing is actually becoming a threat, and we have seen orders of magnitude technological progress happen, then I think we should get to the point where we have a multi-phased approach, and essentially phase A would activate, some period of time, several years, like at least 2 or 3 years in the future. Once the BIP gets activated, you have 2 or 3 years, and then a soft fork occurs that now only allows Bitcoin to be sent to a post-quantum script that is considered safe. So basically, no more Bitcoin can be sent to a vulnerable redeem script. And why is that important? Well, because that would essentially be the signal, so that like if people were trying to send their Bitcoin to legacy addresses and all of a sudden their transactions weren't working, they would pretty much be forced to go and figure out what is going on here.
So that's the email
And
boost to everybody.
come again?
That's the email notice to everybody, right?
Yes, yeah, that is basically the flag. That's this is like the only way that we really have to reliably communicate with everyone who's using Bitcoin is to actually, well, break something. Now, we're not at this point, their funds are not frozen. They can create a post-quantum wallet and send the money to that and then continue on normally. But then say 2 years after phase A, which I think would give a lot of people plenty of time to upgrade their wallets at a predetermined block height, then nodes would start rejecting transactions that were using ECDSA or Schnorr to spend funds. And so that would be the like the freezing of vulnerable funds. And so my BIP has this happening like 5 years after activation of the BIP. I think 5 years is a pretty long time period. Of course, some people will object and say that even that is ridiculously short. But this is all about trade-offs, and it's very hard to say how the progression of the quantum technology is going to continue. Like, I think if advancement of quantum computing continues linearly, that's like the best case scenario where we will then get more and more certainty as to like what the deadline will be for Q day. And so this is where a BIP like that will make the most sense. Best case scenario is quantum computing just completely stalls out and we never get to that point and never have to worry about this. But worst case scenario is perhaps some mix of like AI advancement, accelerating quantum computing, hardware and software advancement actually results in like geometric, if not exponential, acceleration of progress in this space. And we all get caught by surprise. And in that case, there's probably not much we can do because we won't be able to react fast enough. And anyways, back to the BIP, the final part that I'm still working on because it's kind of novel is that, the great objection to all of this is, of course, the property rights objection of freezing people's funds. And so I think this BIP will be much more palatable if we can offer an option for people to be able to spend their quantum vulnerable funds even after phase B that freezes the spending of them from using vulnerable EC, DSA, or Schnorr signatures. And I the only way that I figure that this can be done in a soft forkable fashion would basically require you to construct a transaction that spends them the same as usual, but also adds an op return to the transaction that contains a zero knowledge proof. And that zero knowledge proof would essentially need to show that you are the owner of the seed phrase that you can derive the specific private key from the seed phrase with the derivation path. This is because a quantum attacker won't have that information. A quantum attacker can only derive one private key from an exposed public key. They don't know your seed phrase, they don't know your derivation path. So if we're able to figure out a way to construct zero knowledge proofs that you have that additional private information, then that could be sufficient, I think, for people to be able to spend those vulnerable funds safely in such a way that we would know that it's the actual original owner and not a quantum attacker.
And question about this, do you need to be using you need to be using an HD wallet then, right? For this to happen, because there needs to be that derivation path. So is this then why there are some wallets where they couldn't even do this, right? So if Satoshi came back and wanted to move it because it's legacy, okay. So that's like one of the other concerns that people
Yeah,
have.
so Satoshi would need to migrate their coins before phase B, because there is no derivation information available for those really old wallets that were just a bunch of random keys.
Okay, cool. All right. We could probably keep going on, but we are at time and I want to respect everyone's time on this call. But basically, I think the takeaway is don't freak out. Maybe don't buy a bunch of products that perhaps aren't going to be doing what you want them to do because we're not at the point yet where we need those. Not saying what, I'm just saying be aware of, fear mongering and what people are doing to, I don't know. Make money
Quantum
off of
flood
it.
marketing.
Yeah.
Don't
So
panic, transfer all your coins out of a Taproot
yeah.
address.
So basically, don't reuse addresses. Pay attention to the community and what you're hearing about it. Say your opinion in forums. Participate in it if you're interested in doing so. But yeah, don't freak out, I guess is the takeaway. Takeaway, don't freak out. Don't reuse addresses. Any other parting words, Dirk? Did you want to add something?
No,
No?
just
Okay.
thanks to Jameson for being here, because it's always edifying to have a conversation.
Yeah, thank you. Really appreciate it. I actually mentioned to Jameson earlier, I learned about BIPs 32 and 39 from him years ago and then was doing research for this and what I just brought up. I was like, oh, I learned about this from him. So it's fun to have it come full circle and to then again be learning how it's potentially being used or the issues related to these BIPs. Anyways, I could geek out more, but thank you guys for joining. Thank you to our speakers, and we look forward to talking more about this in the future. So, thanks, guys. Appreciate it. And talk soon.
Thanks,
Bye.
everyone.